we're honored to welcome a performer whose talent and advocacy are making waves on Broadway and beyond. Jenna Bainbridge is currently starring as Nessa Rose in the iconic musical Wicked, making history as the first wheelchair-using actor to play the role on Broadway. Her performance brings powerful authenticity and emotional depth to the character, and she's helping to reshape the narrative around disability in theater. Earlier this year, Jenna also appeared in the Broadway production of Suffs. In doing so, she became the first wheelchair user to originate a role in a new musical on Broadway, a groundbreaking achievement that speaks to her range and impact as a performer. Offstage, Jenna is a passionate advocate for accessibility and representation in the arts. She co-founded Consultability, an organization that works with theaters and institutions to create more inclusive, accessible spaces, helping ensure that disabled artists and audiences alike are truly seen, supported, and celebrated. We're excited to dive into her journey, her artistry, and the change she's been helping to create in the industry. Jenna Bainbridge, welcome to Hear Us Out.
Thank you. Oh my gosh, that introduction. That just made me feel so, I'm like all gassed up now. Thank you.
It's well deserved. So to start us off, for the listeners who might not be familiar with your story, would you be willing to share how you became a wheelchair user in the first place?
I don't fully know what my diagnosis is. Doctors have never been able to figure it out. But when I was 16 months old, I became suddenly paralyzed. And over time, I regained some movement and some muscle. But now, all these years later, I am partially paralyzed from the waist down. And it's funny, I didn't, as a kid especially, I didn't think I could use a wheelchair. I didn't think I was allowed. Like, I wasn't, for some reason, I also bought into this idea of like, well, wheelchair use is binary. So if I can walk, I should walk. And it took me until I was really an adult before I started using. I had a wheelchair available to me, but like in my head as a kid, I was like, that's like an extreme thing. It's like days where I really need it. There was no part of me that was like, well, every day I need it. Every day it could help me. And so as an adult, I started using my wheelchair more. And what I found was that I felt so much better. I was using so much less energy just trying to run errands and live my day-to-day life. My wheelchair made everything in my life better. So now I do very strongly identify as an ambulatory wheelchair user, and I use my wheelchair every single day.
Is that something you've found has been hard for people you encounter to understand, that people come into assuming something about somebody who they see in a wheelchair, and then if you don't fit that mold, can you talk about how maybe you educate people or how you handle it when people maybe misunderstand what your situation is?
Mm-hmm. I think it's really a lesson for all of us about all those tiny assumptions we make about the people around us. You should always approach every situation with curiosity and openness. And an assumption is 9 times out of 10 just going to get you into trouble. Meeting someone where they're at and having those open dialogues is so important. And I really try to educate people. I use humor a lot. I am like the first person to make a joke, just to let people know, like, hey, we can talk about disability in a way that is fun and is interesting and is educational. And we don't always have to be really heavy about everything. We can have some fun and some levity. I really like to educate, and this is not something that everybody should have to do by any means. There aren't a ton of resources out there for non-disabled people who want to learn more about disability. You know, we have some great books out there now. There's some great documentaries, but, you know, it's also really helpful to have people online that you can like go and watch a 2-minute TikTok of like, okay, what does this mean? I've got time for 2 minutes. I might not have time to read a whole book. So I really try to educate in every room that I go into then as an actor. One of the first things I do is I will open the floor with a quick, hey, here's me, here's my disability. And I want to answer questions, because hopefully if you get some of that knowledge from me, you then won't ask it of somebody who doesn't want to educate, because it's not their job. They, you know, you should never have to educate if you don't want to. So if you ask that question to me, I'm happy to do it. And hopefully it makes you curious enough that then you do more work. You put in that work by reading those fantastic books, by seeing those documentaries, and really becoming a true ally.
When you were starting your acting career, did other people look at you differently? Did it impact your ability to get roles, to book jobs, or was that not a factor?
Oh my gosh, my disability has impacted every single aspect of my life because of other people's expectations and assumptions. I remember in school, I loved theater. I was auditioning for school shows, and I had a theater teacher that would not let me walk on stage. that every single time I was on stage, I was seated behind a desk usually, or seated on a block on stage, and I would never get to walk. It was always like, well, that's where you stand. And then when the curtain comes down, then you walk. But she was so uncomfortable showing that I had a disability that I was never given the autonomy of like blocking. And that really shaped a lot of what I thought of myself. I thought, oh my gosh, is this something ugly? Is this something that I need to be hiding? I want to be a performer. By the very nature of performing, eyes are going to be on me. So there was a lot to unpack there as I got older. And I kept facing it. You know, when I auditioned for colleges, I wanted to be a musical theater major. And every time I auditioned for a university for a musical theater program, I was met with rejection. I was told repeatedly, we didn't cast you because we didn't think you could complete the dance portion of our degree. And they had never seen me dance. I hadn't done a dance audition for them. I had done my audition in my wheelchair, and they just assumed, oh, you use a wheelchair, that means you can't dance, which is absurd. There are some incredible dancers out there who use wheelchairs. Like, dancing does not, it does not mean you have, you're standing and you are walking. Those are different. And dancing is for everybody. Everybody moves to music, but our definitions of what dancing are become very limited when we say, oh, it has to be ballet, and ballet is performed in this way. Why? Dancing is dancing. It's always been absurd to me when people make those assumptions, because the reality is I love dancing, and I do. I dance every day. But none of these universities would even look at me because they assumed I couldn't. And luckily, there were plenty of people in my life who did see the talent that I had and the possibilities. But, you know, I also had directors tell me I would do a show and go back to audition the next season and have the directors tell me like, oh my gosh, we loved you so much. We loved working with you. We really wanted to cast you. But we felt like if we cast you, we would just be telling the same story again. And I was like, excuse me, half of the actors in your show are the same actors from last year. They're playing similar roles. You are saying that because of my disability. Why can't there be a disabled person in this story too? Mm-hmm. Disability exists in every society, in every walk of life. Every single person can and most likely will experience disability in their life. They should be in every story. So yeah, maybe don't cast me, you know, if you're doing, don't cast me as like two ingenues back to back, sure, but you can have different characters. And that's part of my job as an actor, is to show you that range. So it was definitely hard that people like consistently would underestimate me or not want to include me because of their own expectations of what disability meant. But I also say that every time you're faced with that rejection, those aren't rooms you want to be in anyway. That isn't going to be a good, healthy room for you to be in. So I'm always grateful for the rooms that were excited to have me there. And those opportunities, I went from one to the next, and it eventually led me to Broadway.
It's really interesting hearing you talking about how others project onto you, or how they have their preconceived notion of what it means to be using a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. I think of other conversations we've had on the podcast with athletes who have hearing loss, or people who've been very hesitant to let people around them know what it is that they're dealing with. Can you talk about how other people's preconceived notion of you and maybe what you could or couldn't do and the way other people would project onto you either motivated you or helped you build resilience? Or how did you take those experiences to ultimately land on a Broadway stage?
It's funny that you say that, because as someone with a very visible disability, I was always aware that everyone knew. I couldn't hide it. Unless, and I would do this sometimes as a kid especially, I had a knee brace for mobility and for, I had a knee injury. And so sometimes I would wear that knee brace for support. And I noticed that I was immediately treated better because there was an assumption that, oh, this is temporary. And that knee brace like clued people in to be like, oh, well, maybe she's an athlete because I'm a pretty strong person. Yeah. And it was so baffling to me that the knee brace tells you that I'm not disabled, that this is a temporary state. Why can't we also treat people the same way if it's a permanent state? So yeah, I really felt that people treated me differently if they assumed something was temporary. And so I know lots of people who have felt like they couldn't fully show themselves and their disability because of that. And that just fueled me. That gave me tremendous fire. And I'm a pretty stubborn person. So when I hear no, I like to respond with watch me.
So, good attitude.
Yeah, you know, it got me into trouble a lot as a kid, but I'm grateful for it as an adult. And I think that it's really only fueled me as an actor. It has made me always strive to want to be better than I was yesterday, to learn something new from every single audition, for every single night that I'm performing. I take a moment at the end of the night to reflect and say, okay, what can I do better tomorrow? How can I continue becoming the best performer I can be? I had a goal for myself when I was a senior in high school, and it was, I want to be so good that they can't say no to me. And that drove me to really practice and to really put the work in. And it also has fueled so many of the characters I've played, because the thing about theater is that you are meeting a character in all of the most extreme moments of their life. You've got a 2-hour show. You are fast forwarding from the extreme highs to the extreme lows in this person's life, and having to feel those emotions back to back to back. It's exhausting, but you also have to like really put yourself into that moment. And especially as a very young actor, I had a lot to draw on from my own experiences and the rejection I had faced, the pain of you know, having a disability and trying to manage my disability. I knew how to draw on that feeling. And I think it made me a better performer, and it certainly has made me a more empathetic person.
As I'm listening to you speak, I'm thinking of how we interact with our students. Of like, if a student has a off case with a patient, that the student might feel like, oh no, I don't know anything. Whereas somebody who's been doing this for a while, if you just feel like you had an off interaction with the patient, it's just like, oh, I was off right now. Mm-hmm. If you feel like in a performance, maybe you weren't so on, and however people interact as part of the show, do you feel like the world around you can say if something just wasn't quite right, hey, it was an off moment or an off night? Or do you ever feel like you're getting blamed, not because of the performance, but because of how they may see you or see disability? Does that have greater impact or effect than I would say is fair?
Absolutely. I think that there are plenty of people out there who give so much less grace for mistakes.
It's a good word.
Yeah, it's a really common experience, you know, talking to my other friends with disabilities, this idea of perfectionism, that we feel the need to be perfect in all of our work in particular, because if we are imperfect, people blame it on our disability. And it confirms their bias. So like, I worked at a theater once that I had to call out sick for a show. I missed like a single show. And I found out later that one of the directors there said something on the lines of, well, this is why we don't hire disabled people, because I got sick one time, right? Okay. Like, that's completely unfair expectation. And sure, it's your own bias that you expected me to call out because I had a disability. And maybe I do. Maybe I do need to call out. Maybe that's part of my disability. But also, when I'm there, I'm giving an incredible performance. And shouldn't we extend that grace that people, the industry is inaccessible, and sometimes people need a night off, and that's okay. But by saying, well, you have to be perfect 100% of the time or we're not going to hire you, that is an absurd expectation. And I know it's put on me constantly.
Speaking on the idea of off nights, doing this 8 times a week, I can only imagine that there are nights that you might not feel like going on, or you have something on your mind, or you don't want to go play a character for 2.5 hours. Mm-hmm. You want to be in bed or whatever you want to be doing to take the night off. How do you necessarily walk into a show, a performance, when your mind might not be in the right headspace to put on a whole character?
It's a balance for sure. I take a lot of time to make sure I'm in the right space. And the wonderful thing about being on Broadway and our team here at Wicked is they give so much grace for that. You know, if you feel like you are unable to do the show, that's okay. You call out, and our understudies are incredible here, and the talent runs deep. Like, it is wild. You'll see an understudy and you're like, oh my gosh, this is one of the best performances I've ever seen. So that is wonderful. We always have that option available to us. And our union makes sure that we have a good amount of sick days. And it's lovely. And the expectation on Broadway very much is, you know,
Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
You take care of yourself because it is a marathon, not a sprint. You have to be here for, my contract is a year. Other people have been here for 5 years or 10 years. 8 shows a week for 10 years is really hard. So if you need to protect yourself by taking a night off so you can come back for the next, 300 days, great. That's perfect. Do that. But there are plenty of nights where you just feel off, but you still want to do the show. And I try to make it as fun for myself as possible. So I like to, before the show, I have a pretty regular warm-up routine just to make sure my body and my voice are ready to go. And then if I'm still feeling off after like doing all of that centering, I'll give myself a word or an intention to move through the show with. And it can be anything from tonight, I am curious, to tonight, I am, moved, or tonight I am inquisitive, or so many different adjectives, but I'll choose a word. And sometimes I'll pull up a random word generator for it. And that way I can approach the show with a different lens, and it makes it, it's a different exercise then for your brain, which is really helpful, especially when you're having trouble focusing. Giving a very specific intention can help to really redirect that interest.
Given all of the challenges and nonsense you would have had to deal with to get to where you are today, can you speak about the moment that you first stepped onto, rolled onto, got onto a Broadway stage, and what that was like being in front of that audience? And from the theater advisor who wouldn't cast you or thought you could only do certain things to the, I've made it. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. I mean, it certainly was a moment of, oh my gosh, this is why you believe in yourself. And there were so many people who believed in me along the way. And it was so much more about them than anything else. It was, oh, thank God for my voice teacher. Thank God for my high school theater teacher. Thank God for, that theater camp I went to when I was 10 years old, and they pulled my mom aside and said, make sure she keeps doing this. I was grateful for all of those people. And then from a personal point, it was so interesting being on the stage, and I immediately got anxious, and it felt like stage fright. And I hadn't had stage fright in years. It had become normalized. And I was transported back to the first time I had led a show when I was, 18 years old, a professional show. And I remembered that feeling in my chest of just like tightness in my chest. And I'm on stage, and it's first preview of Suffs, and I feel my chest tighten. And I'm like, oh my gosh, we're here. We're on Broadway, the thing I've always wanted since I was a little kid, and for most of my life, never thought would be possible, because I'd never seen someone like me on Broadway. And that feeling in my chest was so tight. And then as soon as the music started, it all just faded away. And I was in the moment. And the thing I realized is that every one of those big moments, it is the biggest thing you've ever done to that point. So it felt like it did when I was 18 working at a dinner theater. It felt like it did when I was 15 being in my high school musical. It felt like it did when I was 8 or 10, however old I was, in the very first show I did. It was that same feeling inside of me. And as soon as the music started, that is released, because you're now the character. You're now in that moment. And so it was a really comforting thing to realize that, no, this is what we do. It's has a different name sometimes, but honestly, the feeling of performing on Broadway is the same feeling at its core of being in community theater or being in my high school theater.
Mm-hmm. I actually saw you in Suffs back in October, November time. And at the time, I thought, oh, the character has a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that it was the actor that is in a wheelchair. Can you talk about the difference for you in being an actor playing a character that's not necessarily supposed to be wheelchair bound, but you as the actor are, versus playing Nessa, where both you and the character use a wheelchair?
Absolutely. Every character that I play, regardless of their own disability, has a disability, because I have one. And the difference for me is whether ableism exists within that world, the world of the show, because a lot of times if my character has a disability, ableism exists in that world. And if my character doesn't have a disability, just me, the actor, has a disability, they are removed from that. The way that people are treating them is different. It's not impacted by disability in the same way. That being said, ableism always exists for our audience. The audience is coming into our show with their own preconceived notions of society and what they're bringing with them into the theater with us. So as a woman with a disability, I know that the audience is going to have that lens viewing our show. And what is exciting to me about playing non-disabled characters, especially, is that it shows the audience what is possible. It shows them a world in which ableism doesn't exist, in which, you know, in Suffs, for example, I played so many different characters, and I was a reporter, I was a police officer, I was a doctor, I was an activist. Here is a world where disabled people can do all that and more, and no one is treating them poorly or has any bias towards them. And we can do that in our own world, too. Here's an example. So I love that possibility. And then on the flip side, I think that disabled characters should always be played by disabled actors because non-disabled people don't understand that lived experience. My body, my disability shouldn't be a costume piece for somebody else. It is my daily life. It is my daily experience. And that's really exciting to bring that to a show, any show. People with disabilities make up 20% of the population. So in theory, 20% of the roles we see on TV, on stage, on film should also have a disability. And by doing that, we end up normalizing disability in every way. People become more comfortable with it when they see it.
You said something a few minutes back that stuck with me. You talked about how the team of Wicked, how good they are, and that people who historically look like you, you wouldn't see on Broadway. And I remember Meg saying the exact same thing when mm-hmm. she was on with us probably 5 months ago, 6 months ago. And to me, as an outsider, that speaks to the caliber of the team in seeing the individual and the quality of the work of the individual and wanting who's best at the role. Can you talk about the team around you and how that has seemingly created such a positive environment and situations where you all get to be role models for those out in the world?
Yeah, the team at Wicked and the team at Suffs as well, I really commend both teams, were so passionate about finding the right people for the role. So that felt more like a meritocracy than other experiences I've had auditioning. It wasn't about how many followers do they have on social media, or are they a name we can sell, or do they have the look? It was who can do the job well. And at Suffs, there was also an element of, and do we want to be in a room with them, right? Are these people that we want to work with that are passionate and empathetic? And, you know, because Suffs was built over many years. So there was that element of you can really get to know somebody as you're building it. Wicked, I had two auditions. So they're not necessarily going to know me very well over two right. auditions, but they're going to know my talent in those two auditions. Mm-hmm. The team here is incredible and so devoted to the quality of the show. We get notes multiple times per week, which is not the case on most Broadway shows. So people are watching and really, they really care. There's so much care, and not just for the show, but also for us. And our stage management team is incredible and so supportive. I had to call out a few weeks ago. We had an 11 show week because of a holiday.
Wow.
And I did the first 10, and on the 11th show, I was like with the stage manager, and I was like, I don't think I can do one more. I am exhausted. And she was like, this is exactly when you need to rest. And I'm proud of you for going home and resting. And I was in bed by like 9:30 that night.
Good for you.
So they really do. They care a lot about take the rest now so that you're ready to come back full energy. And I really applaud our team for acknowledging that the rest is just as important as the work, because the rest is what allows the work to happen.
There are times at the beginning, whether in Suffs or in Wicked, where you had to advocate for yourself in terms of what you need in the theater. We've actually spoken to a few Broadway sound designers who have talked about the theaters themselves are very old and not necessarily equipped for modern sound design, technology, and I would mm-hmm. expect also physical accessibility needs. So
yes.
What were those conversations like at the beginning?
Yeah, I always have to advocate for myself in every room. Every job I'm doing, I am equal parts an actor and an advocate. And part of that is because there are so few wheelchair users performing on Broadway. So the producers don't know. If they've not worked with a wheelchair user before, they might not know what access needs are necessary. But also, every single person has different access needs. So regardless, everyone's going to need something slightly different. And I really applaud, you know, both of our teams. Again, I feel like I'm repeating myself, but I've been very lucky on Broadway to work with incredible companies. And they really met me where I was at in that moment. So for SUFS, when we moved into that theater, because the difference is that SUFS was a new show and Wicked was already running. So SUFS, there was much more wiggle room for changing things within the theater because there was nothing there. We weren't moved in yet. So they built me a dressing room at SUFS. They built a ramp up to the stage door at SUFS. They built a bathroom that was ADA compliant backstage at SUFS. And those were all things that they were able to do because it was a shell. It was an empty theater to in which we were able to build our show and fill it with the things we needed. And I was part of those conversations the whole time. They would say, here's what we're thinking. Here's what we have planned. How does this look to you? What other changes should we make? And it was super, super smooth. Wicked, also a very old theater, also predates the ADA. And it's a hard one because it's already functioning. You don't have the ability to be like, okay, we'll just stop for, you know, a week and like redecorate, right? We're going to like move everybody out and then we'll like put some ramps in. Like that's not an option when the show is running. You know, SUFS are load in, which is when you like bring everything into the theater. Load ins take like over a week. It's a long time to like get everything in there. And then even once you're fully like quote unquote loaded in, you're still fixing things and changing things over the next couple of weeks as you're doing dress rehearsals and tech and previews. So it takes a long time to make everything function well. Wicked's already got it down. It's a clock. I mean, it's literally a clock. The set is a clock, but like it's also clockwork. It has been running the same way since it opened in 2003. So coming in and adding in a new element of accessibility is hard. They had me come in while I was auditioning to walk through backstage and just talk through what my access needs were and what might need to change in order for me to really successfully do the job if it were offered to me. And it was a really just open conversation back and forth about here's how many stairs I can do before I'm spent. I would need a place to park my wheelchair so that I can bring it with me to the theater each day because I need my wheelchair to commute. I don't necessarily need my wheelchair backstage. So it was a lot of those conversations back and forth about what are the access needs and also what are the expectations for the role? You know, what is the job and what are the physical expectations within that job? It was a good conversation and very open conversation about everybody has access needs. Let's figure out what yours are and how we can make that work within this mechanism.
I myself, in hearing what you're saying, wouldn't even know what questions to ask of how many stairs can you walk before needing a break. And those are questions I would expect they didn't know to ask. So it's on you to have to advocate for yourself. How has that evolved for you over time in your willingness to speak up for your needs? We try and tell our patients how to advocate for themselves, but they're nervous. They don't want to bring up to their boss of certain things that they need because they're afraid that it's going to have repercussions that come with that. So how has it evolved for you?
I've really tried to normalize access needs for everybody, because every single human has them. So sometimes it's just reframing what is an access need, because an access need might be that you need a standing desk, right? That might not have anything to do with disability. It might just be like, hey, I'm more comfortable and I work better with a standing desk. Okay, well, my access need is that I need it in my wheelchair to fit underneath the desk, right? Like these are both access needs for us to do the best work possible. And I think that theater is such a great example of that, because maybe the blocking is set. This is how you're supposed to move around the stage. But inevitably, every single performer is going to do it differently, right? Maybe the shoes that person wore don't work for this person. The heel height might need to change so that they're more comfortable and able to dance easier. They might need a dressing room that has a couch in it so that they can take a nap between shows. These are access needs, and they're really no different. It's just a matter of knowing what to advocate for, knowing the things you need in order to do the job to the best of your abilities. So I have been very aware of my access needs for most of my life. I've got a friend who puts them into the email signature. There's a Google Doc in the email signature that's just a link to accommodations. That's like a little rundown of like, hey, if you email me and you don't hear back within 2 days, please send a nudge. I won't be offended. If I email you at 4 a.m., please know that I don't expect a response and I hope I'm not bothering you. It's just that that's when my...
I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Brain is ready to respond to emails, right? Like all of those access needs, as well as access needs of if your building has stairs in it, please let me know, right? And it can be as simple as that because, like, for me, I use a wheelchair, I can use stairs, but I need a handrail. It is not safe for me going up and down stairs without a handrail. So that's a pretty easy access need for people to like wrap their head around of, oh, we need to have a handhold. Great. And if it was, I can't do stairs, then maybe it's not going to be a good fit, right? Because maybe there aren't any dressing rooms with stepless access. And that, you know, the way that the Gershwin is currently set up, that is the case. Every single dressing room requires at least a few stairs to get to it. And so that was a conversation. And we did it by doing a tour of the theater. So it was, hey, here's how the track is currently set up. Does this work for you? And what would need to change for it to work for you? So they weren't asking necessarily how many steps can you do? It was, here's the steps. Does it work? And I was able to say yes or no.
Have you had a situation where you had to say no?
Yeah. Absolutely. I had a show just a couple of years ago that I had to actually drop out of because, you know, we had had a conversation before casting about what would be expected. And when we got into rehearsals, I found that the reality didn't really match up with what I had expected. And I just felt it would be too difficult and too hard on my body to continue. And that one, it came down to the nearest bathroom during rehearsal was 3/4 of a mile away.
Oh, God.
And I was like, wow. I can't do that. I can't do that with like these long rehearsal days. Like I'm already spending so much energy performing the role. I can't do a mile and a half walk every time I have to go to the bathroom.
Absolutely.
So, you know, and it was outdoor theater and it was the reality of the space they were in. But I'd had to remove myself from the situation. And it's so hard. That was a hard decision for me because I really wanted to do the show. And also as an actor, that's how you get your health insurance is by doing shows. And it's a financial decision. If you have to, you've already put the time aside to be working on one thing. You can't just go back and be like, well, I'll just go do this other thing instead. No, they've moved on. They've cast somebody else. So suddenly you're just left with, I have this free time where I'm not working. I'm not getting my health weeks. I don't have income coming in. Also for that one, I hadn't worked there long enough to qualify for unemployment. There was a lot of things that were difficult, but it was absolutely worth it for me to have to go and do something else.
Do you feel at all limited in the shows that you could potentially see yourself doing in the future just based on what you know of their theaters or requirements or accessibility that they provide? Or do you feel like the world is your oyster, you can go for anything and see what happens?
More in the latter category, because I think that there are plenty of producers and directors out there who will inevitably put their own parameters on what they expect a disabled performer to be able to do, 100%. So I'm sure there are shows out there that won't consider me because I use a wheelchair and because I have a disability. But my mindset is always, why the hell not? Prove it to me. I want to come into your theater and show you all the ways you can be more accessible. And that's part of why I started Consultability. We would talk to theaters that would say, we really do want to hire disabled actors, but we don't know where to start. We don't know how to make our theater accessible, and we don't want to put someone in harm. We don't want to have an inaccessible situation and cause them to go through what I did, having to drop out of that show. Like, that's the worst thing that can happen. So how do we make sure it's a safe place? And how do we make sure that they're going to be able to thrive here? We go in and we show them all the ways that they can do just that. So I always have that mindset of, I do this for a living. I know how to make places accessible, and I know my own access needs really well. But I'm also always trying to advocate for whoever comes next. So every theater I go into, it's not just about me. It's also, well, what if you hired a blind actor in the future? Or what if you hired a lighting designer who used a cane? There's so many possibilities. How do we make this accessible for them too? And it's not always my job, right? I'm just an actor on this show, but it is something I try to make people aware of the possibilities for the future. And then as everybody goes on to whatever shows they're working on next, hopefully they're bringing that mindset with them and they can be more aware, whatever they do in the future, of like, hey, yeah, no, we could make this more accessible if we did this. That's what we did when I worked at Wicked, right? Maybe something that they learn here, they can bring with them to the next place. So I think everything's possible. It's just a matter of being willing to adapt whatever show you're doing to the needs of the individual.
We had a conversation recently with a well-known sound designer who is going to be working with an actor with hearing loss, mm-hmm. and just wanted to be prepared for what to expect. How can he as the designer best work with this actor to have them do their job in the best way and the easiest way for them? And there was something really nice in that conversation that he wanted to have everything be as accessible as possible and accommodating as possible, but he also wanted to be knowledgeable. It wasn't just to allow this actor to do their job. He wanted to understand mm-hmm. what are the effects of hearing loss? What might this person be experiencing? Mm-hmm. And it's from our professional hat, it's nice to see that out in the world when people are wanting to accommodate others to get them what they need to be successful. Mm-hmm. And kind of a flip side to that question I would have, and I love asking this question of the musicians that we know and the stage performers that we know. As the fans, as the audience, they see this person in this role. They're at the peak of success in their industry. They're doing this awesome job that people idealize and would want to be doing. But then when you talk to the people doing it, there's always the but. Yes, it's awesome. I wanted to be on Broadway. I made it. But
yeah.
As far as the behind the scene with Broadway, what's some of the but when it comes to being a Broadway actor, the challenges that people may not see or may not even know come with part of that work?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that the big one is the time commitment. I think people see it as, oh, you only work 3 hours a day. And that's just so not the case, right? The timing is relentless. It is constant. Yes, the show is 3 hours, but the preparation for the show is 100% of your life. You know, it's things like I have to make sure I get a lot of sleep, and I have to work out every day, and I have to do a warm up, and I have to do a cool down. I have to eat right, which means meal prep. Like, all of those are things that I have to do just to get to work. And then the show itself is, as I said before, it's the emotional highs and lows of this person's life. And as anybody can attest, like, really emotional days drain you. And I'm reliving those emotional days 8 shows a week. And Broadway is a marathon where you do it 8 shows a week forever, right? You don't necessarily know when it's going to end. And when I'd worked regionally, you always knew when the contract would end. It was usually 3 to 6 months. And yeah, it was 8 shows a week for 3 to 6 months. But then you had time to like rest and recover before whatever came next most of the time. And Broadway, there is no time to rest. You are continuing it. Other thing that's really hard is that your schedule doesn't line up with any of the people you love. If they don't work in theater, you will not see them for however long your contract is. And when you do see them, it tends to be pretty far apart and it tends to be pretty quick. I'm really grateful that my family and my friends, they'll come and meet me for dinner between shows. My family and friends do come and visit me between shows and before and after shows. But, you know, we're just offset. Like, I leave for work at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And that's right as my husband finishes work at 5. Right. So we're just like passing ships. And then I kind of race home as soon as I can after the show so that I can at least talk to him on the phone for a few minutes while I drive home, because he's asleep by the time I get there. Right. And then he gets up at 6:30 in the morning and I don't get up until 10. Right. So it's, granted, I'm up till 2 o'clock in the morning. So it's, you know, a very different schedule. And I don't think people realize that it's a sacrifice in a lot of ways. We're doing what we love, and that is so rewarding. But it's hard to, you know, to only see my nieces every couple months.
I would also expect that it is a very different experience originating in a Broadway show where you're all doing the workshops and going through it together versus being somebody that is entering an existing show where you don't get to do the full rehearsals with everybody and you might rehearse with another standby. Can you talk about the challenges of that, of entering a show and not necessarily having all the practice with the entire cast and creative team?
Oh my gosh, the first few weeks of Wicked, there were people on stage whose names I did not know because I had not met them. And the first time I would be meeting them, honestly, sometimes would be on stage. I would look and be like, I don't know your name. It took a while to just learn everybody's name. And we have a lot of vacation swings and understudies. And so sometimes they would, fly in, they hadn't even been in the state. They would fly in that morning and be on stage and everybody else knew them. And I was like, who is this person? I see them on the in-out sheet, but a name on an in-out sheet is not the same as interacting with them on stage.
Yeah.
So that was really surreal for the first few weeks. And I'm still experiencing it where someone will come in and I don't get to rehearse with them the first time that I really get to meet them, other than they'll walk around the building and introduce themselves. You don't really get to know them until you're running the show together. And it's very surreal because it's like, oh, the show is almost the same, but there's a completely different person here now. And they're wearing the same costume, but they are not the same person. It's very fascinating. I was lucky when I joined Wicked, there were 5 of us joining the company. And so we all got to rehearse together, which was really important. Yeah. So it was me, Elphaba, Glinda, Bach, and Madame Morrible. We all joined.
Oh, so it's like all the mains.
Yeah. Yeah. So we got to rehearse with our real scene partners. And, when we had our put in, which is when they put us into the show in a dress rehearsal, we were all there together and we had the whole company with us. But I watched some of the rehearsals that have happened since then. And, we've got a new girl who's here as our Elphaba standby. And they rehearse alone in the rehearsal studio with the dance captain and the stage manager. Occasionally understudies would go up and rehearse against them. And that's a very different experience than when you're on stage for the first time and you're like, oh, I've never... The first time that I did a scene with them was during their put in, right? So they're in full costume and having to deal with oh, this is my first time doing it on the stage with everybody here. And we've never read it before.
I would think that leads to, not necessarily that the audience would notice, but some errors, some slip ups, more just because I would think that you all have some cues, some subtle visual cues between each other to communicate on stage. But what happens when something goes wrong on stage, whether it's because you're put in and you're not familiar, or somebody forgets their line, or somebody makes a wrong step? What happens?
The white room.
The white room. Oh my God, the white room is so real. We had a joke in Suffs that there was a trap door that led to the white room, and somebody had loosened the screws on it, because there was one night where 4 different people just completely forgot lines and went to the white room and were just
what do you do?
This is the funny thing about Broadway, because this happens everywhere. Your memory just fails sometimes, or you're doing it with somebody else and the cues get a little weird. But the caliber of talent and professionalism on Broadway is so high that I think 90% of the time the audience has no idea anything was different. Only the super fans, right, who have seen it 20 times. They're the only ones who are going to know that anything was different. And the rest of us, we're just going with it. So sometimes you just make up a new line and hope that it is unnoticed. You say it with enough confidence that the audience isn't going to really think too hard on it. Sometimes you just rely on the people around you to pick it up for you. And really wild things happen. A prop will break, or your costume will not be put on properly and you kind of have to sit, or you just forget a line, or you do the wrong choreography because you're in a different track. I certainly did that as an understudy, where I kind of defaulted to my part and was like, no, that's not the part I'm doing right now. It happens. It happens every single night. There is no such thing as a perfect show. And I think that's part of it, though. There is no such thing. So we think of big moments of something going wrong. And the biggest one I can think of on Suffs, we had an automation failure one night, and we have this desk on stage that was supposed to go down through the trap door and then the trapdoor closes over it.
And it
went down, and then there was a big hole on stage. And there was just no, it was just open. And we finished like the rest of that sequence just around the hole. We just like kind of locked eyes with each other and like made sure we were safe and gave distance. And it closed after a minute. There was also a night where, yeah, the desk just didn't go. It just stayed on stage. And we had to do this whole dance number with a desk in the middle of the stage. And that one was really fun because then during curtain call, we like really drew attention to it. We were like, that's not supposed to be there. And so the audience was like, great, that's why the choreography was weird. And yeah, there's photos and videos of that night of us like sitting on the desk and like, you know, playing with the phone on the desk during curtain call because it was like, it's still there.
I wonder if that's what keeps it fresh, is that there, as you said, there's no such thing as a perfect show. And then it adds to the uniqueness of each show. It doesn't become monotonous.
Mm-hmm. The best thing for a show is to have coverage on, to have an understudy on. And so like, if you are going to see a show and you open that program and there's a slip that says you have an understudy on, you are in for such a treat. Because when coverage is on, everybody's attention goes up. Because you're having to be really in the moment. You have to listen. You have to be ready to adapt. And it doesn't matter if it's the lead of the show or someone in the ensemble. If there is coverage on, everybody is paying that little bit more attention. And it's a really good thing for the show.
Do you look forward to that? Is that something that when you see there's going to be coverage in a show, is that exciting in a good way? Or does it become like a... shit, I need to be on tonight.
I love it. It keeps the show so exciting because you're like, what's going to happen? Like, you're excited for them to go on. And, you know, there's always the excitement. I love like a new debut. That's the best. When someone's on for that part for the first time, you know that they're going to have friends in the audience. And that's really exciting. The audience is just rooting for you in a different way. But also just as an actor, it's really fun to do your scenes and to sing your songs with someone new. It reminds you of all of the excitement and possibility that there is.
Eric, this is why she does the job she does and we do the jobs we do. I couldn't deal with that, that unpredictability. I would get too nervous about if it's not according to plan, if somebody new is entering. That's a whole new set of variables that you're dealing with, but it sounds like it has its whole set of positives.
Absolutely. Acting is like, I had a teacher say like acting is equal parts acting and reacting. And it really is. And I think the reacting is what makes the great actors. If you are able to, I had a director once who said that his favorite actor in every show is whoever can figure out how to pick up that dropped prop without drawing attention to it. That is his, and it is a special skill to be able to see like, oh, something fell. I have to pick it up and make it seem like it's part of the show. Not everybody can do it. And it's what sets apart the good actors from the great actors is that ability to just be in the moment, go with the flow, and keep mistakes within the world of your show.
Is that something that you find can be learned with experience, or is that just you have it or you don't?
It's definitely experience. I think it's more about experience than anything else. It's also something that I think disabled actors are really good at because we're constantly having to adapt to a world that was not built for us and bringing that onto stage. We are the first ones to come up with a new idea and to change the perspective because we have to do that every single day.
You know, one of my favorite questions, I would say one of our favorite questions to ask on the podcast is, can you think of a time where you got to become a part of somebody's story? We talk about it from our context with our patients with hearing loss, whether it's helping them with a cochlear implant or hearing aids and getting to be able to hear again and have access to sound. And we then have the pleasure of becoming a part of their hearing journey. Can you talk about a time whether you were able to influence somebody or somebody had an influence on you that really was a meaningful moment or meaningful experience?
Absolutely. First time that I really felt like I had made a difference in someone's life, I was 18 years old, 19 years old. I was doing a production of Cinderella and we always took pictures after the show. I would stay in costume and you know, kids would come up and take pictures with me. And one day I get this letter, you know, like fan mail from the theater. And it was this mother writing to me and she enclosed the photo of me with her child and said, you know, my child came to see Cinderella and uses crutches to walk and really wanted to audition for her school play, but was too scared. And after she met you and saw you in Cinderella, she signed up for auditions that very night and said to me, if Jenna can do it, then so can I. And it changed her entire outlook on auditioning for theater. And she got to, the mom told me that she ended up being cast and she was able to have that theater experience that was so, so important to me, especially at a young age. And she was excluding herself from that because she had never seen herself represented. And by seeing me, it changed her mindset on what was possible. And that was so empowering and exciting to know that that little girl's life was changed. And I get messages like this pretty much every day. I'll get a letter, I'll get a DM on social media from people saying that it was the first time that they had really felt represented in a Broadway show, seeing me roll out in my wheelchair.
There are probably a set of cons, and what I would say is having a visible disability, because it brings along those preconceived notions we talked about earlier, as opposed mm-hmm. to somebody with hearing loss that has a more invisible disability. But in situations like that, it has its set of pros, that this is how you're able to influence people around you and get those messages, because people see you and see what you mm-hmm. can do.
Yeah, people immediately know that I have a disability. And I generally love my disability. I love my life and the way that I move. Yes, of course, there are things in my life that would be easier if I didn't have my disability, but most of them come down to ableism in society. They don't come down to anything that I feel about my disability itself. And so, yes, there are people out there who might treat me differently because of my disability. But it's also a really good way to filter people. I noticed this a lot when I was dating, where I was like, if you don't like me because of my disability, you're probably a very shallow person anyway, and I wouldn't want to date you regardless. So it's kind of a filter for friends, for employers. I feel like because my disability is so visible, people like naturally filter themselves out of my life. And I'm grateful for that.
It shows you who really should be in your orbit.
Exactly.
Do you feel a sense of responsibility in that receiving those DMs and those messages and the letters and hearing about the influence you have on people and the way you can have this positive impact in others' lives? Does that come with a sense of responsibility where if there's times that you just want to be Jenna? And you just maybe don't want to be seen or don't want to have the world perceive you in a certain way. Do you feel a sense of responsibility or a weight of responsibility?
Yeah, there's certainly responsibility. However, I think it's also important to show people flaws and to show, you know, people with disabilities are full humans with flaws and strengths. So yeah, if you see me on a bad day, okay, you're going to have a bad day too sometimes. It just happens. So I try not to put out any kind of expectation that I'm like the poster child for disability, because that's absurd. But I think that there is certainly responsibility that I want people overall to feel well represented, to feel if they are feeling themselves being seen on stage for the first time, that they are proud of that. There's not, oh God, this is the person on stage. Oof, like she's not representing us well. I really do want to represent my community well, my family well. And I think most people feel that responsibility and feel that weight. You never want to, at least most people I know, you don't want to let your family down. You don't want to let yourself down. My community is just a little bit bigger. There's a few more people who I really want to make sure are feeling well seen, well represented, and appreciated.
My last question for you that I wanted to ask. My aunt was a theater buff. She'd go 3 times a week probably for since the late 60s in the city. And she always used to say that people in New York, hey, we have this reputation, but if you, before people had phones, you needed to stop somebody on the street and ask for directions or ask where something is or ask for help, they're never going to say no to you.
No.
Can you talk about what your experience has been as a New Yorker on Broadway, around Broadway, interacting with people?
Yeah. New York is funny because they're not going to be nice about it, but they are always going to help. And I love that. It's like, no, we're skipping the small talk. We're not wasting any time. We're going to be super efficient about this. you need help. That's right. I'm doing it because that's the right thing to do. And it's so different from, I feel like I've lived so many other places where it's like, as an example, when I was 15, I was visiting New York for the first time and my front wheel got stuck in a pothole. And this guy was walking from the other direction and literally just picked up the front of my chair and got it out of the pothole and kept walking. Never said hi, never. My mom and I were like,
that's about as New York as it gets.
Fully. And we were like, oh my God, that's exactly what we needed. He saw the problem. He fixed the problem. We're moving. This is great. If that same thing had happened to me in Denver, I feel like it would have been a like, oh, hi. Do you need help? Oh, let me see if I can find somebody. Oh, there's a great cafe over there. I could walk over there and see. Okay, I'll be right back. You're like, I just need to get out of the pothole. Like, and so it's like a really pleasant interaction, but you're like, at the end of the day, we can help each other and move on. And sometimes that has its detriments, right? Like, consent is important. Please get consent before touching people. But, you know, New York tends to be very, hey, you need help? Okay, good. And that's the conversation. If you say no, they keep walking. If you say yes, they jump in. And the amount of times I see this on a daily basis, you know, gosh, there's always an elevator out. Every time there's an elevator out, I see people carrying strollers up the stairs. And it's always complete strangers who are like, oh, great, you needed help. I carried your stroller. We're going our separate ways, never to speak again. And it's kind of a beautiful society.
Nothing like New York.
Yeah.
So I have two last questions for you. I can't decide which one. So I'm going to do both.
Both.
The first one being, is there any role that you would dream to do one day on Broadway? Anything you would hope to be either in production or a specific role? And the second one being, any advice for individuals with a disability who are interested in getting into theater? What advice would you give for them?
See, dream roles. I am absolutely dying to do The Sound of Music. I love The Sound of Music. I grew up loving The Sound of Music. I've always wanted to play Maria. And that's, if there's ever a Sound of Music revival, oof, I want to be in that room.
There will be one day.
That's one day. That would one revive. Day. And it's just, I just love it. I love the music as a soprano in particular. I want to sing that score. I want to hear it every night. So that's one of my favorites. On the other end, I also am a big fan of Alan Menken, all Alan Menken, but I would love to do Little Shop of Horrors. I really want to play Audrey one day. Those are two.
And that's on right now.
It's on right now, technically off Broadway, but it is still playing. So I'd love to work there. There's so many roles I want to play. I'm so excited about what the future might bring because I could have never predicted where I am now. I'm not going to try to predict what's going to happen in the next few years because I'm just excited to see where the universe leads me. And I think as far as advice for other disabled performers out there, I think honestly, it's good advice to go with the flow of the universe because opportunities, they present themselves in strange ways that you might not be expecting. But I think that persistence is key. I can't count the amount of no's I have received throughout my career, my education, but I always believed in myself and my family believed in me. I had a good support system. I'm very lucky in that way. But generally, if you feel that you are meant to do this, then keep trying. Because yes, you might face 10 no's, but that one yes is all you need. And I also think it's really important to remember that it doesn't matter what level you are performing at. They are all important. And if you are in a community theater, it might be someone's first time ever going to the theater when they see you perform. And how important is that? You might help to inspire a lifelong love of that, of theater in that person. So as you are continuing your journey, Broadway doesn't have to be the goal. Performing in and of itself is such a gift. So all of you disabled performers out there, like, keep going. And every opportunity is a good opportunity if done right.
I love that. That is fantastic advice. And I've been so excited to have you on the podcast. When I first saw you in Stuffs, in the least stalker way I can say this, you captivated me because it was when we first launched this podcast, was around the September, October time, which is when I went to see Stuffs. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. Cause as I said, I didn't realize that I thought it was the character. And once I saw, it's the actor, that I found fascinating and amazing. And then once I saw that you were going to be Nessa in Wicked, I said, okay, deal's done. We have to have her. So thank
you. It's part of why we didn't decorate my wheelchair in Stuffs was to show, like, this is a modern wheelchair, 1913. And it was that my character didn't have a disability. We had all kinds of women in our company who wouldn't necessarily have been visibly present at those protests. And that was the point. We're showing the women of today present in that story. I had a lot of people who thought the same thing. They didn't know I was a wheelchair user in real life. And what an exciting way for them to see disability representation is in a story about activism and inclusion.
Exactly. It felt very fitting in its own way for SUFs, and especially now in Wicked as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So thank you for sharing your story about all the work that you do, all the advocacy, because this is one of those stories that I think our listeners need to hear about seeing where disability can take you as long as you put in the work, you believe in yourself, and you strive. Mm-hmm. So why don't you tell all of our listeners where they can find you, where they can connect with you on social media, if they want to hear more about your work, consultability.
Absolutely. If you want to follow me, I am at Bainbridge Jenna on Instagram and TikTok. And consultability is at consultability, or you can visit our website, consultability.org.
And we'll link to all those in the episode description.
So thank you so much again for coming on. And we look forward to seeing you in Wicked and all the shows you continue to do next.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.